You're listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez. Thank you so much for joining us. And I think it's safe to say that we all dread seeing the flashing lights of a squad car. We have that rush of, oh no, was I driving too fast or I didn't stop back there. But if you're like me, you're a little bit different because you also have an extra adrenaline rush, wondering if this is the day you're wrongfully accused of something that you absolutely didn't do, if this is the day you go to jail and are convicted of something that you couldn't possibly have done. And that nightmare is exactly what happened to Kelly Peters. She is this a name, Charles? I want to make sure that I get the names right because I've written this so quickly. I'm so nervous because we have a writer that you've introduced me, Dr. Charles Turk, who is one of our favorites here. I'm Pretty Late. Forwarded a story to me, and I could not stop reading. I read it. I was just like, okay, I'll take a look at this story. And I just thank you so much for sending it to me, by the way.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let us introduce to our audience my new favorite writer, Christopher Gofford, who writes for the LA Times, and he's masterfully created a 6-part series for the LA Times chronicling the narrative of a suburban PTA mom who really lives the nightmare today, even that I dread. How are you doing, Christopher?
Great. Thanks for having me, Patty.
Absolutely. This story happened. Tell us when this, because I see flashing lights and deep down I think, oh, please let it be because I'm driving too fast and not because someone stuffed a dead body in my trunk. Really, I do.
It's a universal anxiety, and I think that's why this story seems to have resonated. So the basic story is Kelly Peters is a PTA mom at a school called Plaza Vista in Irvine, California, which is sort of the master-planned model city in central Orange County, about an hour south of Los Angeles. She's a well-loved PTA mom. She's been there for years. Parents entrust their kids to her, and one day someone phones in a tip to the local police and says, this woman, Kelly Peters, is driving erratically in the parking lot. I saw her with drugs. The cops go to the school, haul her out, and sticking out of the pouch behind the driver's seat in her car is a bag of marijuana, along with 11 Percocet pills and 29 Vicodin pills. Now, the pot possession is a misdemeanor, but the possession of those painkillers without a prescription is a felony, so she could do serious time. Well, not serious time, but she could see the inside of a jail cell for this. And on top of that, it could ruin her reputation, which she has spent years building. And she begs and pleads with the officer. His name is Charles Shaver. Not to arrest her. She insists that the drugs are not hers, and she spends a couple hours trying to convince him that there's been a horrible mistake or that someone has planted the drugs in her car. So,
and Officer Shaver has to have heard that kind of a response from someone he's pulled over just dozens, if not hundreds of times. It's not me.
Not for me. In fact, he said that's the typical response from people caught with drugs. They always lie. In fact, he pulled drugs out of their pockets, and they say, these aren't my pants. So he is he is used to this.
Sure. He's heard it all.
He's heard it all. And so 99% of the time, a person in this situation is going to go to jail. But he immediately senses something's not quite right about this. First off, the timeline, the caller said that he saw Kelly Peters driving around erratically in the parking lot just before 1:15, and the people at the school said Kelly Peters was there maybe half an hour earlier than that. So the timeline is immediately wrong. The fact that the drugs are sticking so conspicuously out of the back seat as if they are meant to be discovered, that also rubs him as rubs him wrong. And there are a number of other things, like the insistence with which she's proclaiming her innocence.
Did you happen to ask Officer Shaver if in his experience he had seen a crime staged in this way, where it's just so obvious to him?
I think this was unique in his experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think people probably try and frame other people all the time. The fact that this is Irvine, which is a pretty affluent area where there is almost no violent crime, and in fact, it's ranked number one on the FBI's crime stats list year after year as the country's safest city for its size. The entire city was designed with crime deterrence in mind. So there's really very little serious crime, and the cops are well trained. And this particular cop, who is a sniper, who's very patient by nature, and trained to lie in his belly for hours looking at a window from a rooftop, very, very methodical. He used to work as an investigator for NCIS. He's not the ordinary street cop. By chance, this case fell to him, and he started looking into it. And by the end of the day, he's got a strong conviction that Kelly Peters is probably being set up. Then the question becomes, by whom?
Go, Charles.
Oh, and you had as you noted, had it been any other cop, she might have been hauled off, and that might have been the end of the case. It might have been the end of her reputation.
Yeah, and if this had happened in one city over, which is Santa Ana, where they're dealing with serious violent crime all the time, or in Anaheim, which is right down the road, where they have gangs and shootings and serious crime, the outcome here would have been very, very different. We debated in the newsroom whether there was something about Irvine and its hyper-regulated, hyper-competitive sort of yuppie weirdness that might have given rise to this crime, or whether it might have happened in any other affluent city. And what the conclusion I came to is the plot to frame her probably might have been hatched in a lot of cities, but I don't think the culprits would have been caught in most cities.
Part of what's so interesting about it, I think, the portrait, the tableau that you set is, when I take a look at the picture on the website, actually, that sort of the
of the LA Times.
Yeah, of the LA Times. I can't remember. I think in Facebook speak, we would call it the cover photo. It reminds me very much of the 1982 film Poltergeist. It's sort of just this picture perfect setting. And that's actually between the photo and the skillful the mastery you have with words. That's very much the portrait that's laid out. So that's what it reminded me of. It's just this picture perfect setting.
Just beneath the surface.
Well, exactly.
Madness.
And I have to say, and I think we'll get into this a little bit more. Just anecdotally, I've shared this story with, just about anybody who I think will listen, and it seems to me, and I'll be interested in hearing in a bit, from you, how successful it's been. People can't seem to put it down. And I think that it's really sort of hit a nerve.
I think you're right. And I thought that it would resonate. I didn't know it would really catch fire the way that it seems to have. I mean, we've got now 3 million readers, which is a record for the year for a story for us.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And we're approaching 7 million page views. We don't often run serials, but I think the way we laid this out for readers has something to do with the number of readers that it's managed to grab, because we ran it over the course of a week. First part was on a Sunday, then we spread the other parts out so that the final part ran on the following Sunday. And by the end, I was getting hundreds of emails saying, please tell me what happens next. I need to know. I can't wait. I can't wait. Where do I get an early version?
Well,
so if you've done that as a writer, I feel like you have you have done your job.
I agree. I couldn't stop. I mean, I just kept scrolling and scrolling. I mean, it really is one of the most readable things I've had the pleasure of consuming in the last, I can't even tell you how long. I mean, I love our writers all over. We have a great writer here in Chicago named Peter Nickias, and he has the unenviable job of covering some of the most violent crimes in Chicago. And so there are great writers. This is the kind of thing that I think we wrap our arms around, because we have that fear, that phobia of someone having a vendetta so deep and so visceral that they have to act on it and ruin someone's life. And we are talking again to writer Christopher Gofford, who has written Framed for the LA Times. You can go to latimes.com and become one of the over 7 million people who have clicked on that story and enjoyed it. Christopher, we have to hold on for after the news. Do you mind? We can call you back if that's easier, or do you mind listening to our local news report?
I'll hang on.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much. Again, more after this on Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez, 720 WGN. You're listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, live in the Allstate Showcase studio. Joining me in studio is Dr. Charles Turk, a favorite here, one of my guests we have regularly. And on the line with us, we have writer Christopher Gofford, who has written a piece for the LA Times. It's a six-part series that you do not want to miss. And you can't, because it's going to be there forever. This story will, I think, always fascinate people. I mean, Christopher, you've written the story about Kelly Peters, who was wrongfully pulled over. Well, she was pulled over because someone had reported that she was driving erratically, that somebody had seen drugs in her car. And she's the officer who pulled her over, fortunately.
She was pulled out of school, actually.
Was she pulled out of school? I thought she was pulled over.
She's pulled out of school, right?
Oh, see, I'm misremembering, because I put myself in the car being pulled over.
She's in the middle of her regular routine.
That's right.
Volunteering with kids. She's walking a group of martial artists. Little 10-year-old martial artists through their warm-up exercises when the cops arrive.
That's right.
And say, "We'd like the keys to your car, please," and they find the drugs in there.
The report had been she had been driving erratically.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So one of the first things the police do is they trace the call, and they find that it came from a wall-mounted phone in the lobby of a luxury Newport Beach hotel called the Island Hotel, and they go down to the basement there and start looking at surveillance footage, trying to figure out who walked into the business office where the call was placed when it was placed. And they're actually thinking that it is one of the rivals for Kelly Peters' PTA position. Sort of a local thorn in the side of police, who's well known in the area, and they're looking for him on the surveillance camera. It turns out the person they see is a tall, lanky man in a dark coat with a white shirt, walking into the lobby and then walking out of the lobby right around the time of the call. And it turns out to be a man named Kent Easter. Now, Kent Easter is a $400,000 a year lawyer for one of the bigger firms in Orange County. And he's married to a woman named Jill Easter. And as police begin to investigate, they find out that the Easters have a grudge against Kelly Peters, and it all stems from something that happened a whole year earlier.
A chance encounter, a moment, just one word. I've gone over this in my mind, because this is what drives me nuts about this. There's so many things, Christopher, that drive me nuts about this. But go ahead and tell us the word that was used and the encounter that drove Jill Easter nuts.
Well, the word is slow, and what happened is Kelly Peters is one of her jobs there at the school was to gather the young kids up on the backyard, the recess yard, after their after school activities. She'd gather them up and lead them through the building and hand them off to her parents. And on this particular day in 2011, the Easter's 6-year-old son was left out back for anywhere from, well, it's probably not more than a few minutes. The Easter's claim that it was up to 19 minutes. The school claims that it was a far shorter period, maybe 6 minutes or something like that. But Jill Easter became fixated on this. She demanded to know why her son was left out back. Why had the tennis coach brought him up? Was that proper? And Kelly Peters said, look, he was a little slow to line up. That's happened before. And Jill Easter seemed to take offense to that word. She seemed to think that Kelly Peters was implying that her son was somehow intellectually slow, and this really offended her. She began waging a campaign to get Kelly Peters fired from the school, or ousted, I should say, from her volunteer position at the school.
And this is in your interviews with Jill Easter. Is there anything that indicates why she jumped to that? Because here's the thing. I have a child who is intellectually, physically challenged. She has special needs. And I have another child who is often behind because he takes his time. He fantasizes. He's daydreaming. He's thinking of something else rather than getting ready to where we have to go. And if someone says he's slow or it was taking his time, I would be like, okay, you know. And I would be so grateful that he was okay when he wasn't with the other kids.
And Christopher, you distinguish, you know, very clearly, too. I mean, you make a point of this. You know, there's very clearly a difference between lollygagging, which is clearly what Kelly Peters meant, and being intellectually or cognitively slow.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, people said that about me all the time, that I was that I was slow to line up. I was the kid who didn't get collected.
Lackadaisical. We were lackadaisical.
Lackadaisical. Right.
Right.
So, but for some reason, Jill Easter took that very personally, and she started writing these letters. She started calling the school. As it happened, Kelly Peters loved the boy. She adored him. She thought he was a terrific kid, very artistic. He would run up to her and show her his drawings. She says, I thought he was amazing. So the school principal talks to Jill Easter by phone the week after the incident, and Easter says she wants her to do something about this. She wants her to get rid of Kelly Peters. She mentions that she and her husband are attorneys. Jill Easter went to Berkeley Law School, which is one of the best law schools in the country. Kent Easter went to Stanford and then UCLA Law. So they were both high-powered lawyers. At the point this story begins, he's making the money for this big firm, and she is a stay-at-home mom who has quit the practice of law.
And all the time in the world to think about perceived slights.
Ooh.
You know, that's one point that people have mentioned in some of the letters and emails I've received about this, is that, you know, they wonder whether boredom might have played a factor in this. So she, the principal learns that Jill Easter is going up to parents on campus to denounce Peters. Principal tells her, look, this could be construed as harassment. This is not civil. The school has a rule about civility. And according to the principal, Jill Easter replies, she is perfectly within her rights to do this, and she might be making a sticker or a sign for her car next saying what Kelly had done. And Kelly Peters, who'd volunteered for a long time without any controversy, was really disturbed by all this, and she volunteered to leave the school, and the principal said, no, you're our best volunteer. We don't want you to go. But it begins to escalate, and the Easters file a civil suit claiming that their son had been the victim of false imprisonment and, you know, had suffered intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the school stood by Kelly Peters, and a whole year had passed between this incident and the day that the drugs appeared in Kelly Peters' car. So when they see Kent Easter walking through the lobby on the surveillance video to make the phone call that summoned cops to the parking lot, they believe finally they have their man.
Did you have another question?
It's more of an observation. I mean, I guess I'll couch it in a question too, but it's sort of centering back on that, this whole idea of perceived slights, because some people, that I've talked to come away from the story, saying, okay, I get the motive. Other people, don't. And I guess, do you buy into, the idea finally of that being ultimately what the motive was, that the Easters had, that being the perceived slight?
Well, I mean, this is 5 years ago now this has happened. There have been two criminal trials and a civil trial and a grand jury proceeding, and no other motive has been advanced. So as weird as it seems and as baffling as it seems, this is the best we've got. I do remember the judge in the civil case saying this is the most inexplicable case I've dealt with in 50 years in the law. He says there just doesn't seem to be a connection between the perceived slight and the extremity of the retribution that was exacted here. I remember the judge saying, look, I just handled a multiple murder, and as horrible as that is, it falls within the realm of graspable psychology, right? And he says, I can understand if a guy goes into a bar and his wife is grabbed or something, and he pulls a knife and someone hurts another person. It's horrible, but it's something you see. This is something that just does not make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And in some ways, that makes it doubly horrifying.
And that's why I started this way, is that, just that chance encounter set everything into motion. And there's so much more to the story. I have to take a quick break here, Christopher, and we have to cut in with the Cubs results. If you don't mind standing by, I want to be able to wrap up with you. And I almost think that we need to do, in the same way you have a 6-part series in the LA Times, and everyone should go to latimes.com. I feel like we should have like a reading group so people can start reading the story and then check in with you maybe next week. And I think we'll all have more questions. Can you hold on for a few moments?
Sure.
Wonderful. Carm, do you want to jump in? Do we have, wait, what do I have to roll up? I'm not used to, oh, there, that one, this button, yes.
Patty?
Yes. What do you want? I'm talking to an LA Times reporter.
I know, it's very important, but more important than that, the giant.
No, it's not. Hold on. Also important. It's also important.
No, fine,
I'm very excited.
Fine.
All right,
fine,
then. Yes.
Fine. Sports is life. Sports is the most important thing. Everybody should be focusing on that. 6-2 Giants over the Cardinals. That means the Chicago Cubs officially your NL Central Division champions for the first time since 2008, an 8-year wait. Will they end the 108-year wait?
Stop asking. Just yes.
Okay, fine.
Stop asking. Just yes.
Yeah, so it's all over. The Giants beat the Cardinals tonight. Cubs, of course, lost to the Brewers, but that doesn't matter anymore. The Cubs said they were all going home from Wrigley, not sticking around. Joe Maddon, the same deal. So I don't know if anybody's left in that clubhouse.
We party tomorrow. We party when we win tomorrow.
Yeah, I would assume they will play the afternoon game tomorrow.
And they'll skip. I'm going to ask that all of the Chicago Cubs skip to first base.
Great.
Or run backwards. You're all, like, maybe a gallop, something. Carm, will you come down and talk to me after midnight? We have a writer, Christopher Gofford.
I will. I'll see you after midnight.
All right. More with our writer, Christopher Gofford. More Cubs celebrations when we come back on 720 WGN. More Dr. Charles Turk, too.
Grab your saddle shoes and letter sweater, because we're heading back to the 1950s this weekend on the Mr. Fix-It Show. At 8:35, we're going to talk to a couple.
You're listening pretty late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, live in the Allstate Showcase studio. And we've been talking to writer Christopher Gofford from the LA Times, who's written this amazing piece, Framed. And we were going to finish with a question about the popular culture and what captures people's imaginations. You know what, Christopher? I think we're going to hold that question until next week so that we give you a chance to really formulate what we mean by that and what you think, because you mentioned that over 3 million people have been reading this, 7 million people have clicked on it. I think that's kind of what Charles was going for. So I think that we should talk about that next week. What do you think?
Yeah, and I'd love to know what your listeners think once they've had a chance to read it.
Right, because part of it is this is a story about, you know, a suburban, successful, you know, people who live in a community that has very little crime. So why are people so compelled by it? And I think part of it is what's going on, you know, culturally is part of what Charles was talking about. But I think we can get more into that next week when more of our listeners have an opportunity to read that story on the LATimes.com site.
Great. Let's do it.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Again, go to latimes.com. Christopher Gofford is also has his own website. You can read more of his work, and we can talk to him again next week and call in with any questions and thoughts that you have. And have a great week. I'm not sure what, if you're a baseball fan or not, but we're hoping to meet the Dodgers in the, somewhere down the line.
Okay. great. Great to be here, Patty. I'll talk to you guys next week.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
It is time for our news. It's been kind of a crazy night, and again, I want to thank Christopher Gofford for joining us and Dr. Charles Turk for sharing this amazing story. Again, Framed is on the LA Times website. Go to latimes.com. You just scroll down. You'll find the six-part series. It's such a great read. I'm not making an assignment. You're not going to be quizzed. You're not going to be graded, but we want to know what you think of it as well. Right now, it is time for our news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.